awakening came, but with a surprising turn that throws into new perspective the whole problem of the hero circuit, as well as the mystery of a mighty king's request for sleep as the highest conceivable boon. Vishnu, the lord of the world, had become incarnate in the person of a beautiful youth named Krishna, who, having saved the land of India from a tyrannical race of demons, had assumed the throne. And he had been ruling in utopian peace when a horde of barbarians suddenly invaded from the northwest. Krishna, the king, went against them, but in keeping with his divine nature, won the victory playfully by a simple ruse. Unarmed and garlanded with lotuses, he came out of his stronghold and tempted the enemy king to pursue and catch him, then dodged into a cave. When the barbarian followed, he discovered someone lying there in the chamber, asleep. "Oh," thought he, "so he has lured me here and now feigns to be a harmless sleeper." He kicked the figure lying on the ground before him, and it stirred. It was King Muchukunda. The figure rose, and the eyes that had been closed for unnumbered cycles of creation, world history, and dissolution opened slowly to the light. The first glance that went forth struck the enemy king, who burst into a torch of flame and was reduced immediately to a smoking heap of ash. Muchukunda turned, and the second glance struck the garlanded, beautiful youth, whom the awakened old king straightway recognized by his radiance as an incarnation of God. And Muchukunda bowed before his savior with the following prayer: "My Lord God, when I lived and wrought as a man, I lived and wrought, straying restlessly through many lives, birth after birth I sought and suffered, nowhere knowing cease or rest. Distress I mistook for joy, mirages appearing over the desert I mistook for refreshing waters, delights I grasped, and what I obtained was misery. Kingly power and earthly possession, riches and might, friends and sons, wife and followers, everything that lures the senses, I wanted them all, because I believed that these would bring me beatitude. But the moment anything was mine, it changed its nature and became as a burning fire. Then I found my way into the company of the gods, and they welcomed me as a companion. But where still, surcease? Where rest? The creatures of this world, gods included, are all tricked, my Lord God, by your playful ruses. That is why they continue in their futile round of birth, life agony, old age and death. Between lives, they confront the Lord of the Dead and are forced to endure hells of great degree of pitiless pain, and it all comes from you. My Lord God, deluded by your playful ruses, I too was a prey of the world, wandering in a labyrinth of error, netted in the meshes of ego consciousness. Now, therefore, I take refuge in your presence, the boundless, the adorable, desiring only freedom from it all." When Muchukunda stepped from his cave, he saw that men, since his departure, had become reduced in stature. He was as a giant among them, and so he departed from them again, retreated to the highest mountains, and there dedicated himself to the ascetic practices that should finally release him from his last attachment to the forms of being. Muchukunda, in other words, instead of returning, decided to retreat one degree still further from the world. And who shall say that his decision was altogether without reason? The Magic Flight.
Now comes the way of return. Dante went through the three worlds, but came back and wrote about it. If this has been the mode of achievement, we will have flight, what's called the magic flight. Or we may have a return that is protected by the powers. Return. You know the magic flight, it's very favorite of the fairy tales. The hero or little Hansel and Gretel or somebody like this are running away from a pursuing monster, and they throw things over their shoulder. They throw a comb over, it becomes a forest, and the monster comes through until finally we get to the threshold again, back to the light world, and you're out.
If the hero in his triumph wins the blessing of the goddess or the god, and is then explicitly commissioned to return to the world with some elixir for the restoration of society, the final stage of his adventure is supported by all the powers of his supernatural patron. On the other hand, if the trophy has been attained against the opposition of its guardian, or if the hero's wish to return to the world has been resented by the gods or demons, then the last stage of the mythological round becomes a lively, often comical pursuit. This flight may be complicated by marvels of magical obstruction and evasion. The Buryat of Irkutsk in Siberia, for example, declare that Morgan Kara, their first shaman, was so competent that he could bring back souls from the dead. And so the Lord of the Dead complained to the High God of Heaven, and God decided to pose the shaman a test. He got possession of the soul of a certain man and slipped it into a bottle, covering the opening with the ball of his thumb. The man grew ill, and his relatives sent for Morgan Kara. The shaman looked everywhere for the missing soul. He searched the forest, the waters, the mountain gorges, the land of the dead, and at last mounted sitting on his drum to the world above, where again he was forced to search for a long time. Presently, he observed that the High God of Heaven was keeping a bottle covered with the ball of his thumb, and studying the circumstance, perceived that inside the bottle was the very soul he had come to find. The wily shaman changed himself into a wasp. He flew at God and gave him such a hot sting on the forehead that the thumb jerked from the opening and the captive got away. Then, the next thing God knew, there was this shaman, Morgan Kara, sitting on his drum again and going down to earth with the recovered soul. The flight in this case, however, was not entirely successful. Becoming terribly angry, God immediately diminished the power of the shaman forever by splitting his drum in two. And so that is why shaman drums, which originally, according to this story of the Buryat, were fitted with two heads of skin, from that day to this, have had only one. One of the most shocking of the obstacle flights is that of the Greek hero Jason. He had set forth to win the Golden Fleece. Putting to sea in the magnificent ship Argo, with a great company of warriors, he had sailed in the direction of the Black Sea, and though delayed by many fabulous dangers, arrived at last, miles beyond the Bosphorus, at the city and palace of King Aeetes. Behind the palace was the grove and tree of the dragon-guarded prize. Now the daughter of the king, Medea, conceived an overpowering passion for the illustrious foreign visitor, and when her father imposed an impossible task as the price of the Golden Fleece, compounded charms that enabled him to succeed. The task was to plow a certain field, employing bulls of flaming breath and brazen feet, then to sow the field with dragon's teeth and slay the armed men who should immediately spring into being. But with his body and armor anointed with Medea's charm, Jason mastered the bulls, and when the army sprang from the dragon seed, he tossed a stone into their midst, which turned them face to face, and they slew each other to the man. The infatuated young woman conducted Jason to the oak from which hung the fleece. The guarding dragon was distinguished by a crest, a three-forked tongue, and nastily hooked fangs. But with the juice of a certain herb, the couple put the formidable monster to sleep. Then Jason snatched the prize. Medea ran with him, and the Argo put to sea. But the king was soon in swift pursuit, and when Medea perceived that his sails were cutting down their lead, she persuaded Jason to kill Apsyrtus, her younger brother, whom she had carried off, and tossed the pieces of the dismembered body into the sea. This forced King Aeetes, her father, to put about, rescue all the fragments, and go ashore to give them decent burial. Meanwhile, the Argo ran with the wind and passed from his ken. The Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, and hundreds of analogous tales throughout the world, suggests that in spite of the failure recorded, a possibility exists of a return of the lover with his lost love from beyond the terrible threshold. It is always some little fault, some slight yet critical symptom of human frailty that makes impossible the open interrelationship between the worlds, so that one is tempted to believe almost that if the small, marring incident could be avoided, all would be well. In the Polynesian versions of the romance, however, where the fleeing couple usually escape, and in the Greek satyr play of Alcestis, where we also have a happy return, the effect is not reassuring, but only superhuman. The myths of failure touch us with the tragedy of life, but those of success only with their own incredibility. And yet, if the monomyth is to fulfill its purpose, not human failure or superhuman success, but human success is what shall have to be shown. That is the problem of the crisis of the threshold of the return. We shall first consider it in the superhuman symbols, and then seek the practical teaching for historic man. Rescue from without. The hero may have to be brought back from his supernatural adventure by assistance from without. That is to say, the world may have to come and get him. For the bliss of the deep abode is not lightly abandoned. Society is jealous of those who remain away from it and will come knocking at the door. If the hero, like King Muchukunda, is unwilling, the disturber suffers an ugly shock. But on the other hand, if the summoned one is only delayed, sealed in by the beatitude of the state of perfect being, which resembles death, an apparent rescue is effected, and the adventurer returns. When Raven of the Eskimo tale had darted with his fire sticks into the belly of the whale cow, he discovered himself at the entrance of a handsome room, at the farther end of which burned a lamp. He was surprised to see sitting there a beautiful girl. The room was dry and clean, the whale's spine supporting the ceiling and the ribs forming the walls. From a tube that ran along the backbone, oil dripped slowly into the lamp. When Raven entered the room, the woman looked up and cried, "How did you get here? You are the first man ever to enter this place." Raven told what he had done, and she bade him take a seat on the opposite side of the room. This woman was the soul, Inua, of the whale. She spread a meal before the visitor, gave him berries and oil, and told him meanwhile how she had gathered the berries the year before. Raven remained 4 days as guest of the Inua in the belly of the whale, and during the entire period was trying to ascertain what kind of tube that could be running along the ceiling. Every time the woman left the room, she forbade him to touch it. But now, when she again went out, he walked over to the lamp, stretched out his claw, and caught on it a big drop, which he licked off with his tongue. It was so sweet that he repeated the act, and then proceeded to catch drop after drop as fast as they fell. Presently, however, his greed found this too slow, so he reached up, broke off a piece of the tube, and ate it. Hardly had he done so when a great gush of oil poured into the room, extinguished the light, and the chamber itself began to roll heavily back and forth. This rolling went on for 4 days. Raven was almost dead with fatigue and with the terrible noise that stormed around him all the while. But then everything quieted down, and the room lay still. For Raven had broken one of the heart arteries, and the whale cow had died. The Inua never returned. The body of the whale was washed ashore. But now Raven was a prisoner. While he pondered what he should do, he heard two men talking up on the back of the animal, and they decided to summon all the people from the village to help with the whale. Very soon, they had a hole cut in the upper part of the great body. When it was large enough, and all the people had gone off with pieces of meat to carry them high up on the shore, Raven stepped out unnoticed. But no sooner had he reached the ground than he remembered he had left his fire sticks within. He took off his coat and mask, and pretty soon the people saw a small black man wrapped up in a queer animal skin approaching them. They looked at him curiously. The man offered to help, rolled up his sleeves, and set to work. In a little while, one of the people working in the interior of the whale shouted, "Look what I have found! Fire sticks in the belly of the whale!" Raven said, "My, but this is bad. My daughter once told me that when fire sticks are found inside a whale that people have cut open, many of those people will die. I'm for running." He rolled down his sleeves again and made away. The people hurried to follow his example. And so that was how Raven, who then doubled back, had for a time the whole feast to himself. This story of the rescue from without shows in the final stages of the adventure the continued operation of the supernatural force assisting the hero. His consciousness having succumbed, the unconscious nevertheless supplies its own balances, and he is borne back into the world from which he came. Instead of holding on to and saving his ego, as in the pattern of the magic flight, he loses it, and yet, through grace, it is returned. This brings us to the final crisis of the round, to which the whole miraculous excursion has been but a prelude. The paradoxical, supremely difficult threshold crossing of the hero's return from the mystic realm into the land of common day. Whether rescued from without, driven from within, or gently carried along by the guiding divinities, he has yet to re-enter with his boon the long-forgotten atmosphere where men, who are fractions, imagine themselves to be complete. He has yet to confront society with his ego-shattering, life-redeeming elixir, and take the return blow of reasonable queries, hard resentment, and good people at a loss to comprehend. Crossing of the return threshold.
Now, this threshold of return is no joke. It is very often more difficult than the quest. Here you were following your lure, the allure of the unknown. Now you're going back to something that you had left behind. It's a little bit like getting back into a wet bathing suit. There are a couple of junctures possible. Let me imagine, for instance, a young man from Wisconsin whose father was a rather stern cattle butcher or something like that. He thought this an unlikely life for himself, so he goes in quest. He comes to California, let's say, and with the aid of a number of nymphs, goes through a long season of quest for his own spirit and his own art and his own inspiration and so forth. And by golly, in the hot baths of Esalen, it comes to him. And this is lovely and fine. And now he's going to go back with what he's found. He's been able to jot a few things down or perhaps make some paintings or something. And he's going back to the world to present them. And he's heard that 57th Street, New York, is the place of all the galleries and all the publishers and all. So he comes with his offering, and they look at it and they say, so what? Well, that's a pretty bad jolt. There are three responses he may make. One is, to hell with them. I'll go back to the hot bath. And stay there. And why not? They don't deserve what you've got. You've found it. It's great. This is called the Pratyeka Buddha, the one who remains a Buddha for himself. Perfectly valid, perfectly standard way. Second way is to look around and just see, well, what do they buy? You have learned something. You are stronger than they. You have been out. You do have a perspective on them. You can give them what they want, full tilt. So go ahead. You can become a commercial artist. You're going to say, what do they want? I'm going to give it to them. And you do. The only kind of commercial artist who is to be deeply pitied is the one who says, I'm going to go on writing potboilers until I've got my pile, and then I'm going to write the book. Well, what he finds, inevitably, is that his style has been determined by his pot-boiling period, and he can't write the book. It has died beneath layers of activity for the society in its own terms. You see what you've done. You've come back, and you've let the society stay where it was. You haven't given them your jewel. And your jewel, it has a way, just as the monsters that follow you had a way, of fading at the daylight level, unless it's fostered.
The two worlds, the divine and the human, can be pictured only as distinct from each other, different as life and death, as day and night. The hero adventures out of the land we know into darkness. There he accomplishes his adventure, or again, is simply lost to us, imprisoned or in danger. And his return is described as coming back out of that yonder zone. Nevertheless, and here is the great key to the understanding of myth and symbol, the two kingdoms are actually one. The realm of the gods is a forgotten dimension of the world we know, and the exploration of that dimension, either willingly or unwillingly, is the whole sense of the deed of the hero. The values and distinctions that in normal life seem important disappear with the terrifying assimilation of the self into what formerly was only otherness. As in the stories of the cannibal ogresses, the fearfulness of this loss of personal individuation can be the whole burden of the transcendental experience for unqualified souls. But the hero soul goes boldly in and discovers the hags converted into goddesses and the dragons into the watchdogs of the gods. There must always remain, however, from the standpoint of normal waking consciousness, a certain baffling inconsistency between the wisdom brought forth from the deep and the prudence usually found to be effective in the light world. Martyrdom is for saints, but the common people have their institutions, and these cannot be left to grow like lilies in the field. The boon brought from the transcendent deep becomes quickly rationalized into non-entity, and the need becomes great for another hero to refresh the word. How teach again, however, what has been taught correctly, but incorrectly learned 1,000,000 times? That is the hero's ultimate difficult task. How render back into light world language the speech-defying pronouncements of the dark? How to translate into terms of yes and no revelations that shatter into meaninglessness at every attempt to define them? How communicate to people who insist on evidence the message of the all-generating void? Many failures attest to the difficulties of this life affirmative threshold. The first problem of the returning hero is to accept as real, after an experience of the soul-satisfying vision of fulfillment, the passing joys and sorrows, banalities, and noisy obscenities of life. Why re-enter such a world? Why attempt to make plausible, or even interesting to men and women consumed with passion, the experience of transcendental bliss? The easy thing is to commit the whole community to the devil and retire again into the heavenly rock dwelling, close the door, and make it fast. The story of Rip Van Winkle is an example of the delicate case of the returning hero. Rip moved into the adventurous realm unconsciously, as we all do every night when we go to sleep. In deep sleep, declare the Hindus, the self is unified and blissful. But though we are refreshed and sustained by these nightly visits to the source darkness, our lives are not reformed by them. We return, like Rip, with nothing to show for the experience but our whiskers. The returning hero, to complete his adventure, must survive the impact of the world. Master of the Two Worlds. Freedom to pass back and forth across the world division, not contaminating the principles of the one with those of the other, yet permitting the mind to know the one by virtue of the other, this is the talent of the master. The cosmic dancer, declares Nietzsche, does not rest heavily on a single spot, but gaily, lightly, turns and leaps from one position to another. It is possible to speak from only one point at a time, but that does not invalidate the insights of the rest. The myths do not often display in a single image the ready transit. Where they do, the moment is a precious symbol, full of import, to be treasured and contemplated. Such a moment was that of the transfiguration of the Christ. From Matthew. Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them into an high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face shone as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias. While he yet spoke, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, Tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man is risen again from the dead. Here is the whole myth in a moment. Jesus the guide, the way, the vision, and the companion of the return. The disciples are his initiates, not themselves masters of the mystery, yet introduced to the full experience of the paradox of the two worlds in one. Peter was so frightened he babbled. Flesh had dissolved before their eyes to reveal the word. They fell upon their faces, and when they arose, the door again had closed. The individual, through prolonged psychological discipline, gives up completely all attachment to his personal hopes and fears, no longer resists the self-annihilation that is prerequisite to rebirth in the realization of truth, and so becomes ripe at last for the great at-one-ment. His personal ambitions being totally dissolved, he no longer tries to live, but willingly relaxes to whatever may come to pass in him. He becomes, that is to say, an anonymity. The law lives in him with his unreserved consent. Many other figures, particularly in the social and mythological contexts of the Orient, who represent this ultimate state of anonymous presence. The sages of the hermit groves and the wandering mendicants who play a conspicuous role in the life and legends of the East. In myth, such figures as the wandering Jew, despised, unknown, yet with a pearl of great price in his pocket, the tattered beggar set upon by dogs, the miraculous mendicant bard whose music stills the heart, or the masquerading god, Wotan, Viracocha, Edshu, these are examples. As the Shankaracharya Vivekachudamani states, Sometimes a fool, sometimes a sage, sometimes possessed of regal splendor, sometimes wandering, sometimes honored, sometimes insulted, sometimes unknown, thus lives the man of realization, ever happy with supreme bliss, just as an actor is always a man, whether he puts on the costume of his role or lays it aside, so is the perfect knower of the imperishable always the imperishable, and nothing else. Freedom to live.
How can I get what I have to give to them? Not just what do they want, but how can I use what they want as a gate, as a door for giving what I feel they need. It's a much more compassionate approach. It involves compassion, not resentment, hostility, and violence. You can't give unless you're going to let the barrier drop that you had to put up to get away. All of the requirements are changed in the return. Here, everything that they were was enough to drive you away. But if you're going to come back, you've got to see those things in a kind of perspective. I call this, then, the delivery of your elixir. And the symbology is of the awakened world. What do you have to give? It may be just a suggestion for the elders of the city to knock the buildings in the most beautiful place in the California coast. Or it may be a new religion. Or it may be a whole new inspiration in the arts or whatnot. But that is the circle. And you ought really to try to know what stage of it you're on. And don't try to universalize this for everybody, as though everybody ought to be where you are.
What now is the result of the miraculous passage and return? The battlefield is symbolic of the field of life, where every creature lives on the death of another. A realization of the inevitable guilt of life may so sicken the heart that, like Hamlet or like Arjuna, one may refuse to go on with it. On the other hand, like most of the rest of us, one may invent a false, finally unjustified image of oneself as an exceptional phenomenon in the world, not guilty as others are, but justified in one's inevitable sinning because one represents the good. Such self-righteousness leads to a misunderstanding not only of oneself, but of the nature of both man and the cosmos. The goal of the myth is to dispel the need for such life ignorance by effecting a reconciliation of the individual consciousness with the universal will. And this is effected through a realization of the true relationship of the passing phenomena of time to the imperishable life that lives and dies in all. As the Bhagavad Gita describes it, even as a person casts off worn-out clothes and puts on others that are new, so the embodied self casts off worn-out bodies and enters into others that are new. Weapons cut it not, fire burns it not, water wets it not, the wind does not wither it. This self cannot be cut, nor burnt, nor wetted, nor withered. Eternal, all-pervading, unchanging, immovable, the self is the same forever. Man in the world of action loses his centering in the principle of eternity if he is anxious for the outcome of his deeds. But resting them and their fruits on the knees of the living God, he is released by them as by a sacrifice from the bondages of the sea of death. Again from the Bhagavad Gita, do without attachments the work you have to do, surrendering all action to me, with mind intent on the self, freeing yourself from longing and selfishness, fight unperturbed by grief. Powerful in this insight, calm and free in action, elated that through his hand should flow the grace of Viracocha, the hero is the conscious vehicle of the terrible, wonderful law, whether his work be that of butcher, jockey, or king. The hero is the champion of things becoming, not of things become, because he is. Before Abraham was, I am. He does not mistake apparent changelessness in time for the permanence of being, nor is he fearful of the next moment as destroying the permanent with its change. In the Metamorphosis we read, nothing retains its own form, but nature, the greater renewer, ever makes up forms from forms. Be sure there's nothing perishes in the whole universe. It does but vary and renew its form. Thus the next moment is permitted to come to pass. When the Prince of Eternity kissed the Princess of the World, her resistance was allayed. A Grimm's fairy tale describes it this way. She opened her eyes, awoke, and looked at him in friendship. Together they came down the stairs, and the king awoke, and the queen, and the entire courtly estate, and all looked at each other with big eyes. And the horses in the court stood up and shook themselves. The hunting dogs jumped and wagged their tails. The pigeons on the roof drew their little heads out from under their wings, looked around, and flew across the fields. The flies on the wall walked again. The fire in the kitchen brightened, flickered, and cooked the dinner. The roast began again to sizzle, and the cook gave the scullery boy a box in the ear that made him yell, and the maid finished plucking the chicken. The Hero Today. The democratic ideal of the self-determining individual, the invention of the power-driven machine, and the development of the scientific method of research have so transformed human life that the long-inherited, timeless universe of symbols has collapsed. In the fateful, epoch-announcing words of Nietzsche's Zarathustra, "Dead are all the gods." One knows the tale. It has been told 1,000 ways. It is the hero cycle of the modern age, the wonder story of mankind's coming to maturity. The spell of the past, the bondage of tradition, was shattered with sure and mighty strokes. The dream web of myth fell away, the mind opened to full waking consciousness, and modern man emerged from ancient ignorance like a butterfly from its cocoon, or like the sun at dawn from the womb of Mother Night. It is not only that there is no hiding place for the gods from the searching telescope and microscope. There is no such society anymore as the gods once supported. The social unit is not a carrier of religious content, but an economic political organization. Its ideals are not those of the hieratic pantomime, making visible on earth the forms of heaven, but of the secular state, in hard and unremitting competition for material supremacy and resources. Isolated societies no longer exist except as areas to be exploited, and within the progressive societies themselves, every last vestige of the ancient human heritage of ritual, morality, and art is in full decay. The problem of mankind today, therefore, is precisely the opposite to that of men in the comparatively stable periods of those great coordinating mythologies which now are known as lies. Then all meaning was in the group, in the great anonymous forms. Today, no meaning is in the group, all is in the individual. But there, the meaning is absolutely unconscious. One does not know toward what one moves. One does not know by what one is propelled. The lines of communication between the conscious and the unconscious zones of the human psyche have all been cut, and we have been split in two. The hero deed to be wrought is not today what it was in the century of Galileo. Where then there was darkness, now there is light. But also, where light was, there now is darkness. The modern hero deed must be that of questing to bring to light again the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. Obviously, this work cannot be wrought by turning back or away from what has been accomplished by the modern revolution, for the problem is nothing if not that of rendering the modern world spiritually significant, or rather, phrasing the same principle the other way round, nothing if not that of making it possible for men and women to come to full human maturity through the conditions of contemporary life. Indeed, these conditions themselves are what have rendered the ancient formulae ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious. The community today is the planet, not the bounded nation. Hence the patterns of projected aggression, which formerly served to coordinate the in-group, now can only break it into factions. The national idea, with the flag as totem, is today an aggrandizer of the nursery ego, not the annihilator of an infantile situation. And the numerous saints of this anti-cult, namely the patriots whose ubiquitous photographs, draped with flags, serve as official icons, are precisely the local threshold guardians whom it is the first problem of the hero to surpass. Nor can the great world religions, as at present understood, meet the requirement, for they have become associated with the causes of the factions as instruments of propaganda and self-congratulation. The universal triumph of the secular state has thrown all religious organizations into such a definitely secondary and finally ineffectual position that religious pantomime is hardly more today than a sanctimonious exercise for Sunday morning, whereas business ethics and patriotism stand for the remainder of the week. Such a monkey holiness is not what the functioning world requires. Rather, a transmutation of the whole social order is necessary, that through every detail and act of secular life, the vitalizing image of the universal God-man who is actually in all of us may be somehow made known to the consciousness. And this is not a work that consciousness itself can achieve. The whole thing is being worked out on another level through what is bound to be a long and very frightening process, not only in the depths of every living psyche in the modern world, but also on those titanic battlefields into which the whole planet has lately been converted. But there is one thing we may know, namely, that as the new symbols become visible, they will not be identical in the various parts of the globe. The circumstances of local life, race, and tradition must all be compounded in the effective forms. Therefore, it is necessary for men to understand and be able to see that through various symbols, the same redemption is revealed. Truth is one, we read in the Vedas. The sages call it by many names. A single song is being inflected through all the colorations of the human choir. General propaganda for one or another of the local solutions, therefore, is superfluous, or much rather, a menace. The way to become human is to learn to recognize the lineaments of God in all the wonderful modulations of the face of man. With this, we come to the final hint of what the specific orientation of the modern hero task must be, and discover the real cause for the disintegration of all of our inherited religious formula. The center of gravity, that is to say, of the realm of mystery and danger, has definitely shifted. For the primitive hunting peoples of those remotest human millenniums, when the saber-toothed tiger, the mammoth, and the lesser presences of the animal kingdom were the primary manifestations of what was alien, the source, at once of danger and of sustenance for those primitive peoples, the great human problem, was to become linked psychologically to the task of sharing the wilderness with these beings. An unconscious identification took place, and this was finally rendered conscious in the half-human, half-animal figures of the mythological totem ancestors. The animals became the tutors of humanity. Through acts of literal imitation, such as appear today only on children's playgrounds or in the madhouse, an effective annihilation of the human ego was accomplished and society achieved a cohesive organization. Similarly, for the tribes supporting themselves on plant food, the life rituals of planting and reaping were identified with those of human procreation, birth, and progress to maturity. Both the plant and the animal worlds, however, were in the end brought under social control, whereupon the great field of instructive wonder shifted to the skies, and mankind enacted the great pantomime of the sacred moon king, the sacred sun king, the hieratic planetary state, and the symbolic festivals of the world-regulating spheres. Today, all of these mysteries have lost their force. Their symbols are no longer of interest to our psyche. The notion of a cosmic law, which all existence serves and to which man himself must bend, has long since passed through the preliminary mystical stages represented in the old astrology and is now simply accepted in mechanical terms as a matter of course. The descent of the occidental sciences from the heavens to the earth, from 17th century astronomy to 19th century biology, and their concentration today at last on humankind itself in 20th century anthropology and psychology, mark the path of a prodigious transfer of the focal point of human wonder. Not the animal world, not the plant world, not the miracle of the spheres, but man himself is now the crucial mystery. Man is that alien presence with whom the forces of egoism must come to terms, through whom the ego is to be crucified and resurrected, and in whose image society is to be reformed. Humankind understood, however, not as I, but as thou, for the ideals and temporal institutions of no tribe, race, continent, social class, or century can be the measure of the inexhaustible and multifariously wonderful divine existence that is the life in all of us. The modern hero, the modern individual who dares to heed the call and seek the mansion of that presence with whom it is our whole destiny to be atoned, cannot, indeed must not, wait for his community to cast off its slough of pride, fear, rationalized avarice, and sanctified misunderstanding. And so, every one of us shares the supreme ordeal, carries the cross of the Redeemer, not in the bright memories of his tribe's great victories, but in the silences of his personal despair. It is not society that is to guide and save the creative hero, but precisely the reverse. Live, Nietzsche tells us, as though the day were here.
Now, to conclude, there's one other Grail romance of this time. And this is the Quest of Del St. Graal, the one in which Galahad plays the role. I just want to conclude this with a little episode from that romance. When one follows the way of the Oriental guru tells one what to do, how to do it, and the aim and end are known. Not so in the West. The big factor in the Occidental heritage, which does not appear in the Oriental, is the accent on the unique capacity and qualities of each individual. All the Buddhas are alike. And in the Oriental tradition, anything like a personal inflection, a personal quirk, a personal inspiration is a defect. Here, that is what is to be brought to flower. In the human brain alone, there are 18,000 million cells. If no two human hands are alike, no two human beings are alike. And so what is good for Tom is not good for Harry. You've got to find your own way. And so here's the episode from The Quest. The knights are in Arthur's dining hall. The Grail appears, covered with a veil. Everyone is in awe. It withdraws. And then Sir Gawain, Arthur's nephew, stands up and says, I propose a vow that we shall all go in quest of that Grail to behold it with unveiled. Next morning they set forth, but these are the words that struck me and that I offer as the concluding sign here. They thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest of adventure at that point which he himself had chosen, and where it was darkest, and there was no way or path. Because where there is a way or path, it is someone else's footsteps. Each has to find his own. And in this romance, whenever a knight sees a path that someone else has followed and tries to follow that, he goes altogether astray. And this is what gives to our Occidental world its initiative, its creative quality, and its romance. We are seeking that which never was on land or sea, that fulfillment of our own unique person, which it is our own business to bring to pass. And so with the secularization of our social life, where no one is telling us, you've got to believe this, you've got to believe that, we're left each to find his own beliefs. Nobody can give you a mythology. You don't have one. You are in the process of making it, and your life will be your mythology. The images that mean something to you, you'll find in your dreams, you'll find in your visions, you find in your creative work, you find in your action, and you find out what they are after you've passed them. So this is a very exciting world we find ourselves in. With the moonwalk and all, the world has moved into a new era. It is an era comparable historically to that which arose in the 9th millennium BC when agriculture and animal husbandry were invented. The whole life of man was changed. That was followed by the rise of cities and the development of the great monumental civilizations, each with its little province. But now when you look from the moon and see the earth rise over the moon horizon, there are no more provinces on this planet of ours. There are no more separate peoples. There are no more chosen or rejected peoples of God or anything else. It is one mankind, and the individual cannot be initiated into a group mythologically. He is being initiated only into his relationship to the entire system. It's a totally new quest. It's a totally new universe we're in. And where it's going, I won't even say God knows.